For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It's so nice to see all of you on this holiday weekend. End of summer, seasons are starting to change, people are going back to school. The rest of us are just working the way we always do. So our senior Dharma teacher, Taigen Dan Layton, is on sabbatical. So many of us that have been hanging around Ancient Dragon for a while are rotating through giving the Dharma talks, and today was my appointed day. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to do this. What I wanted to talk about today is our lineage is the Soto Zen lineage, and it originally was brought from China by a Zen master that lived in the mid-1200s named Dogen. He traveled to China, studied with Chan masters. Chan is the Chinese word for Zen. In the Shaodong lineage, which is the Soto lineage, he studied with Chan masters in China, brought the lineage to Japan in the mid-1200s, and established the practice there. He had a student named Ijo, and Ijo had a student named Keizan, and Keizan is considered another important figure in Japanese Soto Zen because he helped the lineage spread more throughout Japan, still kind of in the late 1200s. And then Shunryu Suzuki, accelerate to the present day, brought this lineage to the United States in 1959. And this is a simplified, you know, version of that story. But as you could see, there's always this idea of one person bringing the teaching to another person, bringing the teaching to another person, and so on, to this present day, which we're still enacting as we practice here together. We're still passing these teachings on among each other in somewhat of a linear fashion. This book was compiled by Keizan, called Transmission of Light, or Transmission of the Lamp sometimes. And it's a selection of 53 different stories about this face-to-face transmission of bringing the teachings from one person to the next, from one person to the next. So in many ways, our lineage is very vast because so many people practice, but in many ways, it's also a very personal, heart-to-heart receiving and giving of the teachings. And these stories focus on 53 individual stories of that going back to India, through China, to Japan, ending up with Ijo. So I've never personally looked at this, and I've never really looked at much of Keizan's teachings, which Douglas was kind enough to do a talk on his instructions for sitting, which made me think I should look at Keizan's teachings a little bit. And I've been curious about this face-to-face extension of the lineage and carrying forward. So I'm going to delve into this, and you're going to join me. So I wanted, my talk is actually not about all of that, the preface to all of it. It's about the first story in this book. Number one, Shakyamuni Buddha. So we're going to look at this together. Shakyamuni Buddha realized enlightenment on seeing the morning star. He said, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Shakyamuni left his palace one night when he was 19 years old and shaved off his hair. After that, he spent 6 years practicing ascetic exercises. Subsequently, he sat on an indestructible seat, so immobile that there were cobwebs in his brows, a bird's nest on his head, and reeds growing up through his mat. Thus he sat for 6 years. In his 30th year, on the day of the 12th month, he was suddenly enlightened when the morning star appeared. Then he spoke the foregoing words, "I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time." These words were his first lion roar. "I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time." So these first words, this first phrase that Shakyamuni spoke, what I'm hearing is we are all one, yet we are all separate. Because there is an I before there's the all beings. We live in a delusional way that kind of masks the fact that we are all already Buddhas. So the enlightenment is there already. We just don't realize it. Hence, sometimes enlightenment is called realization. We become aware, or we realize our true nature, which is always there for us to realize at all times. Zazen, sitting meditation then, is our way in. It's our natural state. It's our way of rediscovering our natural essence, which through the course of our karmic existence tends to get veiled or lost. The morning star is, across time, is symbolic of Venus that could be seen when the sun is rising. And throughout the ages, generally, it's meant fertility and love. The lion's roar is a metaphor for the confidence in this awakening, the certainty of our natural existence, and being so aware of it that we expound it as loudly as a lion's roar. Sometimes we could feel, sitting in Zazen, that we're seeking for something, but we're really not sure what. But yet, at the same time, we can experience moments in our Zazen when it seems like we're home. And for many of us as human beings living in this realm, those times might be fleeting. And those times sometimes might seem to extend. But we could derive confidence in our practice in those times, whether they're fleeting or whether it's an experience we have for more than a second or two. And we could take that confidence in those moments out into the world when we practice. So I love the idea of the lion's roar, because I'm very grateful for this practice, because I do feel the practice gave me confidence navigating throughout this crazy world we live in. The story goes on. After that, he spent 49 years helping others by teaching, never staying in seclusion. With just one robe and one bowl, he lacked nothing. He taught at over 360 assemblies, and then finally entrusted the treasury of the Eye of Truth to Kasyapa, and its transmission has continued to the present. Indeed, this is the root of the transmission and practice of the true teaching in India, China, and Japan. The behavior of Shakyamuni Buddha during his lifetime is a model for the disciples he left behind. Even though he may have had the 32 special marks of greatness and the 80 kinds of refinements, these are mythical ideas of physical traits that you might see in someone that says that they're an enlightened person or a wise person. I don't know all of them, but one of them, for example, is very long earlobes, and there is like a mark on the back of the head at the nape of the neck. So there's 32 of those. That's what he's referring to. Regardless of the special marks of enlightenment that Shakyamuni had, supposedly, we don't know because we weren't there, but we'll take his word for it. He kept the form of an old mendicant, no different from anyone else. I've always also drawn inspiration from the fact that once Shakyamuni realized enlightenment, he went out into the world and he actively taught for the rest of his life. You know, loving kindness and compassion is also a very important part of our practice. Now, if Buddha said, I and all beings together realize enlightenment, compassion is essential for us to realize that connectivity to all living beings. And for me, from my perspective, the idea that he had this awakening and yet actively worked on teaching and refining his teachings and using different stories and methodology is such a great act of compassion. And it props up his lion's roar. It shows how confident he was in what he realized, that he was willing to tirelessly share it with all the other beings so that they may realize they were enlightened with him. They already had what he realized. It was already there. And he tirelessly worked for 49 years until the day of his death, and his death even being an example of the teachings, so that everyone can experience this. And we have this enthusiasm and effort to this very day because the teaching has been passed along from one person to the next for 2,000 and some years. I also feel that in many ways, sometimes we're timid in our practice and we're unsure about this realization and awakening, but his example is telling us we have what we need to engage with the world. Don't be afraid to go out. Have confidence in your practice to engage with everybody because everybody is enlightened. You know, this is me encouraging all of us not to stay in our bubble of like-minded people. Because we have everything we need. Even if being in the world can be painful at times, even if being in the world, we're around people who don't see the world in the same way we do, regardless of that fact, we all experience enlightenment together. We're all connected, and our practice gives us confidence in that fact. So we can go out there, and I like to say rub elbows with everybody who's out there, and not feel that somehow we're going to be polluted. I'll go back to the story. And this kept coming up, his modesty, so I have to say something about it. Also the fact that he didn't elevate himself to some kind of esteemed status above everybody else. When I say go out there and rub elbows, he did that. You know, he was with his students. He lived simply. He didn't glorify himself. We did that to him, right? But he was just there with everybody doing the practice. I want to tell you an aside. One of the other stories I heard about Shakyamuni is as he was establishing the practice over the years, and as the community would get together on a more regular basis, in India it was usually during monsoon season, and if they weren't together during monsoon season, they were traveling around. So when they would all get together, as the congregation and Sangha grew larger and larger, of course little problems arose. And people in the community would tell Shakyamuni, you know, you really need to start establishing some kind of rules of conduct so that everybody could go get along with each other. And this was true, but he said, why don't we wait for a certain problem to arise and then establish a rule of conduct around it? Instead of dictating to people exactly how they should act before we actually have a problem. So this tells you something also about the co-creation of our practice and the importance of mind, the importance of having confidence, the importance of staying positive, the importance of realizing that we're all in this together as we're creating the world that we're living in, as we're creating the Sangha that we're with, which really is all of us. So I was always impressed with that. Like, don't create a problem by creating a rule about the problem before the problem arises. Okay. Therefore, ever since he was in the world, those who have sought the way of his teaching have imitated the Buddha's form and manners, have used the endowment of the Buddha, and in all their doings have always considered the task of self-understanding foremost. What is our exercise for self-understanding? Our sitting meditation. We turn the light within. Having been transmitted from Buddha to Buddha, from adept to adept, the true teaching has never been cut off. This story clearly points to this. Now, Kazan, after he tells the story of all these people throughout this book, he gives some commentary on his perspective of what happened and what, from his practice, he wanted to add to the story. So now we're kind of going into his commentary on some of it. Even though what the Buddha pointed out and explained in the more than 360 meetings over 49 years was not the same, the various stories, parables, metaphors, and explanations did not go beyond the principle illustrated in the story of his enlightenment. That is to say, I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. Even Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. It does not only give birth to Shakyamuni Buddha. All beings on earth also come from here. Just as when you lift up a net, all the holes are raised in the same way, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. And it was not only all beings on earth that were enlightened, all the Buddhas of past, present, and future also attained enlightenment. While this is so, do not think of Shakyamuni Buddha as having become enlightened. Do not see Shakyamuni Buddha outside of all beings on earth. So there is no individual enlightenment. If one person is awake, everyone is awake. Because being awake is realizing that all of us are part of that initial I. The I being the whole of the existence that we're in. The earth is part of that too. Our universe is part of it too. So now, you know, as I was looking at this, and now as they're talking about the eye, I thought of the morning star again, as the morning star being a metaphor for that eye, because it's kind of bright and it's a light, but it's not really anything. It could be anything. And in my mind, because, you know, these words create images in your mind, right? So I see this morning star kind of in the sky, and it looks like an eye to me. But now we're looking at the word I, so it just all kind of had the symbiotic metaphorical thing bouncing around my head. So I just, you know, wanted to share that with you guys. You know, I'm pausing because I have to get my eyes checked again. So every time I look up and look down again, I have to refocus my eyes. It might seem very zen, but that's not why I'm doing it. All the Buddhas of past, present, and future also attain enlightenment. While this is so, do not think that we said that. Okay. However immensely diverse the mountains, rivers, land, and all forms and appearances may be, all of them are in the eye of the Buddha. And you too are standing in the eye of the Buddha. It is not simply that you are standing there. The eye has become you, meaning the eye, this eye, not the I myself. Buddha's eye has become everyone's whole body, each standing tall. Therefore, this clear, bright eye that spans all time should not be thought of as the people evidently here. You are Buddha's eye. Buddha is your whole body. This being so, what do you call the principle of enlightenment? I ask you, is the Buddha enlightened with you? Are you enlightened with the Buddha? If you say you become enlightened with the Buddha, or you say the Buddha becomes enlightened with you, this is not the Buddha's enlightenment at all. Therefore, it should not be called the principle of enlightenment. So now we get kind of koan about this kind of stuff. But what he's pointing to, from my perspective now, is the idea of emptiness, that all of us inherently are impermanent. And when we want to express that in our teachings, we say that we're empty. It doesn't mean that we have nothing. We're an empty shell. But that we don't have anything that can be latched onto. We don't have a permanent identity. We don't have a physical body that remains the same. It's transient. It arises and then it disappears. So we have to go beyond this for us to understand what Shakyamuni meant by I and all beings realize enlightenment. Even so, I and together are neither one nor two. Your skin, flesh, and marrow are all together, and the host inside the house is I. It does not have skin, flesh, bones, or marrow. It does not have gross physical or mental elements. Ultimately speaking, if you want to know this undying person in the hut, how could it be apart from the skin bag? So you should not understand the beings on earth as distinct from yourself. While the seasons come and go, and the mountains, rivers, and land change with the times, you should know that this is Buddha raising his eyebrows and blinking his eyes. So it is the unique body revealed in myriad forms. The ancient master, Fayan, said, "What effacing or not effacing can you talk about?" And Dizong said, "What do you call myriad forms?" So here again is the idea of thinking beyond structured form, yet at the same time realizing that out of this emptiness, all these forms appear. If we look at the bones, marrow, skin of a human body, this is also another line that goes throughout Zen teachings. Bodhidharma, who was the first patriarch of Zen in China, told his four disciples, "You are my marrow, you are my skin, you are my bones." I believe what is being pointed to here is that as a human body has bones, has skin, has marrow, as each one of these things, in a sense, creates a distinct form, they all come together to create a human body. They all come together to create an I. So in this whole universe that we live in, even though we see mountains and rivers and trees and people and animals and the sky and the sun, all of those individual forms we see are all part of the inclusive Buddha, which is all of us, the one body that is Buddha. So I think he's trying to point to that. And how do we experience this? Well, we have a practice that Shakyamuni gave us, Zazen, sitting meditation. Because, again, the Buddha stressed, and Kazan is about to stress, so studying from all angles, penetrating in all ways, you should clarify Buddha's enlightenment and understand your own enlightenment. Kazan tells you from across the years, from mid-1200s to 1300s, he's telling all of us here right now, "I want you to see this story closely and be able to explain it letting the explanation flow from your own heart so that you too may have the lion's roar, those are my words, and not borrowing the words of another. So this also goes back to what the Buddha taught over time. Don't rely on what he's telling you. Don't rely on what anyone's telling you. Buddha stayed with us, elbow to elbow. He wanted to show us, you need to have an experience of this yourself. And earnestly practice so that you could speak of enlightenment yourself. Not do what I just did, co-opt the words of somebody else. So that with confidence we could go out into the world. And through practice know that we've experienced this. Because it's beyond form, it's beyond principles, it's beyond words. It's beyond these things. Keizan closes with a humble saying, and this kind of then gets us more serious again. His humble saying is, one branch stands out on the old apricot tree. Thorns come forth at the same time. So we'll let his words resonate, his kindness, his humble saying. And I'll open the floor up for discussion. So if you have any comments, responses, if you have any questions about anything, I just want to stress, this is a learning temple. All questions are good questions. And if you have a question, somebody else probably does too. So don't be afraid to say what you're thinking or ask any questions. Thank you very much for affording me the opportunity to speak. Hi.
Hi. Could you restate what the lion's roar means?
The Buddha, later on as he was teaching, spoke about this in a parable, that he was saying that realization and the experience of realization, and he used the example of a lion roaring in the forest. When the lion wakes up and roars, all the other animals respect it, and all the other animals quiver. All the other animals are aware of the majesty of the lion in the forest. So I believe the Buddha is pointing to the confidence of realization from actual practice. And I think it's not something that is grabbed. I always say this about authority. If someone has authority, and let's say in this regard spiritual authority, people know it. You don't have to explain it. You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to argue about it. You don't have to convince people of it. They just know it. They feel it because it's an extension of them. So I feel he told the parable of the lion because, like, the animals just know the authority of the lion instinctively. If anyone else could add to the lion, what your perspective is on the lion's roar, thank you if you can. That's what I believe he's saying. And I personally, that resonates with me as well. Like, so I kind of like to believe that's what it means. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for that talk. For example, it's a disease, you know, immune And so the idea that we do impact each other is like, so if someone has an incredible experience, it can ripple in ways that we don't realize. Anyway, just need to think about that.
Thank you. There's one aspect of this story that Kaysan did not list, and which I also like a lot, is when the Buddha was enlightenment, when the Buddha was enlightened, he touched the earth. So sometimes you'll see when he saw the morning star, he touched the earth. Sometimes you'll see depictions of the Buddha statues, you know, touching the earth. And I like it because of the rootedness of the practice on the earth. Meaning that we're rooted, we can't survive without our dear planet Earth and the sun and the universe around us, and that the Earth itself is enlightened as well, with the Earth as all beings. You know, it's not pulling out one thread or just all of us sitting on top of the Earth. The Earth is an integral part of that enlightenment. And our practice is meant to be with the Earth, in this human realm. So I feel that Buddha touching the earth also is like a silent, powerful image of us, our connectivity to it. So thank you, Kathy, for bringing that up. David, hi.
Two things related to the roar. I see the roar as, in a certain sense, of our being. And in our being, people can see the flower that's within them unfolding and blossoming. It's not that we have to go out and evangelize that sense.
Yeah.
But it's just our own being allows that. Other people can see that and allow them to have the awareness that they have it as well. And it unfold. It's my way of viewing it, in a sense, especially because I deal a lot with people in hospice, and there's a lot of kind of an inherent evangelism that's in there sometimes about, you know, you have to find God. It's not a matter of trying to find it, it's just there and let it unfold. And you don't have to teach people in that sense, but just by being. And by being, you're actually doing the practice. You're not trying to say that, oh, I'm better than you because I got it. You know, it's not that. It's just a matter of being. And that, to me, is the lion's roar, in a sense, is our being and just being open and let everybody, you know, see it. We don't have to teach them it. They see it. Going back to what you said about the earth, I'm very conscious about us saying the earth. And the moment we say the earth, we've taken that, you know, specific noun, in a sense, and we separated ourselves from it. Because now it's something apart from us.
Yeah.
And I think of it, you know, as being our earth, that we are the earth as well. We are interdependent. It's not something separate from us, but we are earth. And take away the "the." We are earth, and it is our planet, not the planet. But we are earth in that sense. And we get caught very easily, especially in English, because it's a very, very, very specific language.
That's for sure.
And a lot of other languages don't have that same, you know, way of looking at definitive articles and stuff. We're very, very, very specific. And it's a trap. It's a way of separating ourselves. And I think, you know, one way to approach it is just to look at it, take away the articles, and just say, we are Earth, our planet, our Earth, and we're all part of it.
I remember when we were working on some of the chants, you had us take out the Buddha way.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. Aisha.
So I wanted to also offer a thought about the lion's roar, because I was thinking about it a little bit differently. And I think that when one way that lions express themselves. I don't know if other animals sense their majesty or if they're just, you know, scared and like, gotta run. But that's the lion being itself. And unlike lions, we can be ourselves and we also have the capacity to reflect on our actions. So we can be ourselves in that moment and then in the next moment we can reflect on, okay, was that skillful? Was it kind? Was it helpful? And yet we also can be ourselves. And I always wonder about Shakyamuni Buddha, if every person that he encountered recognized that he was Shakyamuni Buddha, or if some people just said, hey, you know, there's that beggar again. Why does he keep coming around? So it, you know, people aren't always necessarily going to, recognize our experience when we're being ourselves. But that doesn't mean that that's not really us. That's, I think, part of the practice is recognizing, you know, what am I doing right now, and being able to continuously reflect on that, and being able to have some conviction to, you know, who we are and what we're about. And I always think that that's part of what Buddha is doing when he touches the ground, just saying, you know, here I am. So I think that's something that we all do. Metaphor for us being ourselves.
Thank you.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not a pretty sight, us being ourselves. Hi, Hoketsu.
So much in this. Yeah. Oh, what's that? I was thinking about what Kathy was talking about. So I've been reading a lot about trees, probably reading the same books. But and how they communicate with each other. But I thought a lot about some things that story of Kazan's leaves out is this: there's a mutual verification, a blessing, mutual blessing, that it's not just the roaring, but it's like the earth and trees and all universe roaring back and creating that together. And I was thinking about the trees, you know. When Buddha was, he actually sat under a tree, and the tree came to protect him, as the story goes. And before he became enlightened, he ate some food. And a woman brought him some food, you know, she actually was making an offering to a tree spirit and saw this person and said, whoa, is that some amazing thing? So the trees are involved in this whole situation of awakening. And she offered him some food, and he heretically ate some sweet milk rice gruel and sat under the tree, which covered him. So it was this, you know, mutuality and verification. When the earth was touched, the earth actually verified Buddha's enlightenment, and she trembled. So there's this intimacy and blessings that we're constantly receiving back and forth, whether we see it or not. And that lion's roar, the morning star, are all just symbols of that happening all the time to remind us. So that's some of my thoughts about trees.
Thank you. It's a lot going on.
So I want to ask a slightly different question. So,
okay.
So you talk about your is the relationship of the individual and the whole like community. Like there's one word that we use a lot, like interdependent. I also saw that word used a lot by Suzuki in his book. It seems like it really, I don't know if that's a right wording. But it seems like it's trying to describe the scenario where like every individual is dependent, but meanwhile they also kind of connected to each other. So that's actually just wondering, do you have any, can you just say a little bit more about what is Buddha's view on those interdependency ideas? Should we spend more time on cultivating our inner strengths, or should we spend more energy on trying to enhance everyone as a whole community? Which one is? Which one is focused? Probably
is it focused? No, I would say, from my opinion, our life is complex, and we journey through our life. So you might focus on one or the other more at different times of your life. And that's the wonderful thing about practice, is there's not only one way to practice, meaning you must only do zazen and nothing else, because sometimes you can't, let's say you want to do longer sittings because you want to focus on your interior landscape and turn the light within. Maybe the conditions of your life don't allow you to do that because there are other factors. Maybe you're, a graduate student. Maybe you work a job. Maybe you're in a relationship. Maybe you have children. There's a lot of different things that might limit your ability to sit quietly in meditation. So if that's the case, though, thankfully, because of relations, our practice then is in the relations we have with other people. How do we, like Aishin said, how do we skillfully interact with the people that are directly in our lives? Let's not worry about the whole world first. Let's worry about how are we present. Our zazen teaches us how to be completely present. Can we bring being completely present with each person we're interacting with as we move throughout our day? That then is our practice, to be completely present in there for whoever is across from us, and then be completely present in there with whatever activity we might be doing. And then you might move through your life, and now you're at a different point in your life where time opens up and you can do a lot of sitting meditation, and maybe you're withdrawing a little more from building a life, what we call in the West a life, or having more social engagements. Now you'll focus more on turning the light within, but it doesn't mean that you're never going to talk to anybody unless you go live in a cave like some of the hermits, right? And even they talk to people at times, and they're interacting with their environment. But my point is, your life will change because we know it's impermanent. So your practice, we don't want to get rigid about how we're supposed to practice. Your practice and what you focus on is going to change as well. And I feel that the teachers are letting us know that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.